Hello and welcome to episode 67 of Super Podcast. I am your lovely host, Super Marcy, and with me, as always, is my co-host, Bede the Terrible Australian Jermaine. Hello, Bede.
Hello, Marcy. How are you?
I am very well, thank you. How are you?
Oh, not too bad, not too bad. Just busy with a lot of things in my life at
yeah,
the moment.
Like falling asleep at the vegetable store. I mean, falling asleep while reading a vegetable book at the vegetable store, just like Michael Waits in Troll 2.
Yeah, because that's how I roll, man.
Yeah, totally.
It's like, who wouldn't want to fall asleep in a vegetable shop while reading a vegetable book?
I know. It must be quite a sight to see. But before...
Oh, yeah, it's quite a sight seeing me falling asleep on the counter with a vegetable book in front of me.
With a vegetable cookbook. Sorry.
And storage it.
Yeah, but before we we'll introduce our guests first, and then we'll get to why you're terrible, because they'll probably have some input into what you're saying. So,
yes.
Without further ado, please welcome back Sam Inglis, our resident British man. Hello.
It's nice to be back. It's been too long.
It has been a while, but here we are again.
Indeed.
Welcome back to the wonderful podcast. That is super.
Thank you, my dear.
And our other guest, who's never been on the Super Podcast before, so he is going to get a cherry poppin'. Beat with the sound effects. Hopefully that wasn't too painful, so please welcome Mike Ewens. Hello.
Hello, good to be here for the first time.
The very first time.
Yeah.
Hopefully it's not too painful.
We shall see. I'll tell you by the end if I'm seeking therapy. So.
Yeah, you might actually have to do that, but please do not forward the therapy bills to me.
Okay.
I take no responsibility. So,
as the host, I find that shameless. I really do. Well, anyway, it's good to be here.
I hope so. To really get things rolling, we need to ask Bede why you're terrible Australian for this episode of the podcast.
As you should, Darcy.
Yes, I am, right now.
Okay. I'm a terrible Australian because I have seen Gulliver's Travels.
I don't even know what to say.
You didn't read my review, did you?
No, because I wanted to write... I just wanted to give it the verbal lashing that it deserved for my...
All right. Please proceed to do so.
Marcy, I would rather watch The Backup Plan and Furry Vengeance again than watch this movie.
Must be pretty freaking horrid if you're going to say that.
Marcy, this is like the biggest abomination I have seen in the last few years.
Wow.
There's nothing remotely good about this movie.
I can't imagine.
I can't remember who
it would be.
I know I'm terrible for thinking this, but I can't remember who wrote the book. But whoever it was, he'd be spitting in his grave if he ever saw his movie.
Jonathan Swift.
Yeah, Jonathan Swift. He'd probably blast his own brains out in the theater if he saw this movie.
Wow, I need to say that
this movie is so terrible. What can I say about this movie that probably hasn't already been said? It's like it's terrible. It's a miserable, agonizing experience, and it only goes for 80 minutes.
Wow.
So this is like the longest 80 minutes I've seen in a while.
Wow.
And believe me when I say that, Marcy. And there is a scene, there's so many scenes that are so wrong in this movie. Marcy, I want to ask you a question.
All right.
Now, imagine if you are 100-foot Jack Black.
No, but continue. Yes.
If you had to save, like, the people of Lilliput because their castle is on fire.
Uh-huh.
What would you do to save the castle from burning?
Not pee on
Give
it?
Up. He does pee on
no!
the castle.
Oh, my God.
He pisses all over the castle, and he pisses all over Billy Connolly.
Pisses all over the book.
Oh my gosh.
Yes.
Is this really in the movie?
Can I tell you what I wrote about Gulliver's Travels?
Please,
I
started my review with Gulliver's Travels is not a film. It is a hate crime against anyone who loves cinema. Grab a pen and paper for and write a list of everything that is wrong with contemporary cinema. Congratulations, you have just written Gulliver's Travels. Kill yourself.
Wow, I'm speechless.
Horrendously bad. Even by the standards of miserably poor comedy, it is miserably poor.
Wow. I'm actually speechless over this whole thing, like the pinging, your review, like, wow.
And Marcy, I will say this, Emily Blunt in this movie, and you can see the desperation in her eyes that she so did not want to be there.
Wow.
And this is the funny thing. When I was watching the movie, there's a scene where she's about to be kidnapped by the bad guys.
Yeah.
And she like goes, oh, hell, I'm about to be kidnapped.
No.
She says it in that exact monotone of voice. And I actually sat there thinking, is she like pretending she wants to be kidnapped or something like that so she can get away?
She can get out of the movie? Yeah,
like there's like some kind of sub where she's like working for like the bad guys or something.
Wow.
That happened. That was like her line delivery in the movie.
Wow.
It was like,
Emily Blunt's a wonderful actress, but she has no gift for comedy.
I don't know if she has. I don't know about that, but she definitely. You can just definitely tell that she did not want to be there in this movie.
Mm.
You could see in her eyes. I felt so sorry for her. I felt like I wanted to put her down so I can stop from being miserable.
Wow.
Yeah,
that sounds pretty horrendous. Yes,
Gulliver's Travels, definitely one of the worst movies I've seen in the past 5 years.
Wow.
And I've seen everything.
Yes, you have. We know that well. All right, so we'll basically, that'll segue in no possible way, shape, or form to our main topic of discussion, which is we're going to do a top three list, but first we'll start off with honourable mentions for what we consider to be, standout unsung performances, whereas, like, I guess they've sort of maybe not been praised enough or, you know, the people who are doing those roles just haven't, you know, had the recognition that they deserve, if that makes any sense whatsoever. I hope it does. Yes?
Makes sense to me.
All right.
Pretty much makes sense to me.
And we'll get started by going to Sam, because he sort of came up with the idea for this, so he can go first.
Thank you.
Give us honourable mention number one.
Yeah, just a few quick honourable mentions then. The first one is a film that I've been meaning to watch for a long time. And I actually ended up getting to a couple of weeks ago because there was a day when it felt very appropriate. And that's a film called The Rapture. The world was supposed to end recently, so I thought I'd greet The Rapture by watching The Rapture.
Okay.
And it's a really interesting film about a woman played by Mimi Rogers who gets involved in a cult who believe that the rapture is coming, you know, that the rapture is very much imminent. And there's a brilliant performance from Mimi Rogers, both as this woman who is first very promiscuous, very free with her life and her sexuality, and, you know, is very much dedicated to just enjoying herself outside of work as far as is possible. And the progression from that to the end of the film, in which she goes out to the desert with her young daughter to await God taking them to heaven. It's utterly believable. Every step of the way, you're just totally with that performance. And also there is an astonishingly mature performance from the young actress who plays her daughter, a girl named Kimberly Cullum. And they have some really tough and upsetting scenes together late in the picture, and it's not an entirely successful movie, but those are two outstanding pieces of acting, and I hadn't seen much of Mimi Rogers, and I was really impressed in that film. just really impressed. It's a great performance. Hmm. One that seemed to get swept under the carpet recently, a film that seemed to get swept under the carpet, is Sidney Lumet's last film, Before the Devil Knows You're Dead, which didn't really get the audience it deserved, which is a real shame because it's a really tough, interesting little noir with great performances from Philip Seymour Hoffman and especially from Ethan Hawke, who I think is generally a pretty underrated actor, and I think this is probably his best work. He's playing a divorced father who is clearly desperate for money. He's massively behind on his child support, and he gets drawn in by his much smarter older brother, played by Hoffman, into a plot to rob the jewelry store owned by their parents. And, of course, everything goes completely wrong, and it's the desperation in Ethan Hawke that is really intense in that performance. The way he's desperate to cover the tracks to stop his father, played by Albert Finney, from finding out what they've done, and the stupid mistakes he makes and the way he tries to rescue them, the panic in his eyes as he's trying to recover a CD that he left in the rental car that he drove to knock over the jewelry store is just fantastic. And the way he's trying to hold that back and not show it to the person at the rental store. There's a lot of really good work in Before the Devil Knows You're Dead, but I think that's a really standout piece of work from Ethan Hawke and a good introduction to an actor who really doesn't get his dues. So there's that. And finally, among my honourable mentions, I'm going to talk about one of my favourite actresses of the moment, and that's the British actress Rosamund Pike, who I think is wonderful in everything, even Doom. She even tries to do something with the character in Doom, which you've got to laud her for, really. But I'm going to talk about An Education, because she plays one of the supporting roles, a friend of Peter Sarsgaard's, or rather the girlfriend of a friend of Peter Sarsgaard's. And as much as I like Carey Mulligan's performance in An Education, for me, Rosamund Pike is the standout. She plays an incredibly stupid woman and does it absolutely pitch perfectly. You can overplay stupidity very, very easily. And to do it in that film would have totally unbalanced the film, would have made it a broad comedy rather than the sort of comic inflected drama that it is. And she plays it pitch perfectly, so that her character is unfathomably stupid, but in a totally identifiable way. There's a lovely scene when she first meets Carey Mulligan's character and they're talking about going shopping. And Carey Mulligan expresses that a shop would be too expensive for her to go in, but she says it in French. And Rosamund Pike's character is completely taken aback by this. And, you know, what? Why would you do that? Why would you speak French? You speak English. And she just cannot understand it. And it's a wonderful portrayal of total befuddlement with the world. I love her in that. I love her in everything. So those are my three sort of honourable mentions. I don't know if you guys have any thoughts on them.
Yeah, I just want to mention something about The Rapture.
Yeah.
Oh, go ahead.
Yeah, go right ahead.
The Rapture also features some fantastic Nick Cage-style hair acting from David Duchovny, who is just sporting the most incredible mullet. And it's like, you look at that performance and you think, if you hadn't done X-Files, if you'd carried on in the movies, you could have done a fantastic cop thriller with Nick Cage with some of the best hair in all of cinema. I'd have loved to see that movie, but as it is, he's just fantastic on TV. And also, I think The Rapture is a really underrated movie. In fact, I think Before the Devil Knows You're Dead is a really good movie as well. And Ethan Hawke is such a terrific actor. I mean, you know, you could also say go and see Gattaca and Before Sunrise. And even in Daybreakers, which I thought was a pretty rubbish film, he turned in some quite stellar work. So that's kind of my two cents on your picks. Mm.
Well, I haven't seen the first two, which I feel bad definitely for not having seen the second one you mentioned, but I definitely agree with you about An Education and her role in that movie, because she was really, really good. And I absolutely just adore that movie. And
I agree. I have to agree. I loved,
Yeah, go ahead.
But, also, I haven't seen Mimi Rogers in the retrospective. But that's a movie I've been wanting to check out for a while, so I'll have to check it out at some point. But
well, apparently the world's meant to end on October 21st now, so maybe watch it then.
Yep, they've redone their maths. It's a perfect time to revisit the film.
Hell yeah. Anyways, and Ethan Hawke was great in Before the Devil Knows You're Dead, and also I loved Rosamund Pike's performance in An Education. I have to agree with Sam, but it's the role that could have easily have been overdone, but she just does it so pitch perfect, especially for the type of film it was going for, since, like you say, Sam, it wasn't a broad comedy, it was sort of a, you know, a dramedy, so she sort of played it down so it's not too broad or too silly, but just right. It's more believable that way.
Yeah, absolutely.
And that's all I have to say.
Alright. Well, I'll go next, I guess, if that's okay with everybody. Okay.
Fine.
You can, we'll try and mix everything up, so I'll go next anyway. My honorable mentions, and I have three. My first one is, I'm going to go with the movie Heartless, and in particular, the performance by Jim Sturgess. I just think that Heartless is probably just going to just forever live under the radar, and I think that it is just a fantastic film. Like, it was one of my absolute favorites from last year, and I was just so surprised with Jim Sturgess and his performance in this film. And I don't really know much about him or anything, but sort of like after this film, looking back at what he's done, and I mean, I can understand why people might have had their reservations about him being a solid actor, but he was just perfection. And I don't really like saying somebody is perfect in a film, but you know, this is an occasion that he really was. And it was a tough character, like the character of Jamie, the main character, with everything that he's going through. I think it was just something very, very difficult, and I think he nailed it absolutely perfectly. And I really hope this guy goes on to bigger and better things, because after this movie, I know he has it in him. I mean, I guess whether you like or dislike this movie, and even people who I've heard dislike it have said that they thought he was actually really good in it. So props for that. My next one, I'm going to go with a movie that I sort of had, I guess I discovered it a little bit after it came out. And it was sort of always just there on like the shelves. And one day I actually went and saw it. And it was called The Legend of 1900, which is a very strange movie. And the lead in that is Tim Roth, and you know that man has done a lot of films, and when people talk about him, they never mention this movie or his performance in this movie. And I think it is just a very beautiful and heartbreaking performance, and I absolutely, you know, after seeing this, I was just so in love with him as an actor that I sort of really became obsessed. I had to see everything he'd done. And I guess, you know, this movie had a lot to do with that, because I'd seen him in, you know, Reservoir Dogs, which is like one of my all-time favorite films. But I guess I just didn't really occur to me to go out and just see what else he's done. And The Legend of 1900 really made me go out and notice him. And I think it's sort of a shame that more people haven't really seen it or given it a chance, because it is sort of out there, but it is just such a beautiful little film. And the last movie, I sort of really thought about this, and I discovered this little film called Prick Up Your Ears, which is about the playwright Joe Orton. And the performance that really struck me in this, I mean, while Gary Oldman was fantastic, I thought Alfred Molina as his long-suffering lover Kenneth was absolutely fantastic, and it's an earlier role, and I just didn't really expect it from him. And, you know, my eyes kept going to him. I always was paying attention to him, whereas I just thought he was so fantastic. But again, it wasn't something that I'd really heard about anybody really giving him any credit. And he just played it. He nailed it. He really did. And it sort of really, again, it's something that really made me notice Alfred Molina a lot more. And I think he's a great actor. And, you know, this was just definitely one of the best things that he's done. Whew. And there's my honorable mentions, if anybody has any thoughts to add to those.
Well, you're going to be very happy with me because I finally have Heartless sitting on my desk on Blu-ray ready to watch. I haven't seen it yet, but it is there. I will get to it in the next few days, I'm sure.
That was my applause.
I have okay. seen Heartless.
Oh, that's it.
Yeah, no, Mike,
I actually agree with you. I think it's a really interesting movie. It doesn't completely work for me as a film, although I think that's why I like it so much. There are things that don't work and things I want to investigate about it. Mm. But it's a really fascinating and exciting movie, and I think Jim Sturgess is really terrific in it. And I am one of his fans. I mean, I also like Across the Universe, which I know many people hate. I think he's really good in that. Yeah, go away. I understand why people don't like that movie. That's fine. But yeah, he takes on pretty diverse and challenging roles. And, you know, Heartless is... Philip Ridley is a really interesting director. In fact, he's going to come up for me in a minute. But yeah, he drew a really great performance out of Jim Sturgess there. And I agree with your other picks as well. Underrated films, underrated performances. I love Tim Roth. He's great. Alfred Molina, great. Great stuff.
Mm. Indeed.
I 100% agree with Jim Sturgess. I mean,
mm-hmm.
I'm just so thankful that you love this movie, Marcy, because it was actually me who...
Yes, it was.
This movie.
It was.
And I never... And I know because it was weird, though, because I never heard anything about it until I just saw it mentioned on a horror website. I thought, oh, this sounds interesting. So I tracked it down and watched it, and I was just totally loved it. And I was absolutely loved Jim Sturgess's performance. And I knew that everyone needed to see this movie, and I'm just glad that you liked it and you thought the same way as me.
Definitely.
And Sam, if you don't like the movie, I am disowning you as a friend.
As Beeb does when you don't agree with him.
I'm sure there are threats that you've made that should have been followed through on that already for many other movies.
Oh, well, that's true. There'll be like the breaking point one. I'll be like, you.
I've only seen one of Philip Ridley's previous films, but I really like that, so I'm really interested in it. The Reflecting Skin is a really underrated film. If people,
I really
get a
need to check that out. Actually,
yeah,
good reminder.
I've been wanting to see that one too for a long time.
Yeah.
Anyways,
we'll continue. I'll send it over to Mike to give us his honorable mentions.
Okay, and I'll keep it on the theme of Philip Ridley, actually, because I've highlighted his film here, The Passion of Darkly Noon, and I especially want to talk about Brendan Fraser in this film, because I feel like, especially now in the era he's in with his career now, with Furry Vengeance and those sort of films, he gets a lot of hate. And actually, back in the 90s, and even with Crash, which is a film I really, really don't like, but he's really good in it, he's displayed quite a lot of versatility. And in this film, he plays kind of to the image of people have of him, I think, and plays quite a dumb, slow character who's quick to respond to things. He's very shy, sensitive, vulnerable. He's been brought up in this hermetically sealed religious environment, and he's afraid of a lot of things and doesn't understand people. And he's taken in by these two characters, a couple played by Viggo Mortensen and Ashley Judd. She's this kind of smouldering temptress that is completely overplayed, and he's a mute... kind of psychologically fractured individual who occasionally goes into the woods and comes back, and he just comes into their life and disrupts everything. And I don't want to spoil the film for anyone in case they haven't seen it, and it's very hard to get hold of now, but it's worth checking out. He basically just goes completely off the rails and turns into this tribal kind of primal man, completely in touch with his instincts and his emotions, and just goes savagely mental on these people. And it's a really controlled performance and a understated performance. It completely exists in the eyes and the physicality, and he really, I feel like he got into the skin of the character, whereas in other films he's kind of gone quite broad and completely overplayed everything. If you look at films like, and I know they're not the same sort of material, but if you look at The Mummy and George of the Jungle and the kind of kids' fare he's done, it's completely uncontrolled and crazy. But here, it's really controlled, really intense, really fantastic. So that's worth checking out. Mm. My second pick is kind of along the same lines, but it's a, I think it's a Dutch film by Nicholas Winding Refn, who just won the Best Director Award at Cannes. And it's for his last film called Valhalla Rising. And that film has a central character called One Eye, played by Mads Mikkelsen, who is a really fantastic actor anyway. I think he's kind of got these small roles in Hollywood films, like he was in Clash of the Titans and Casino Royale, and he's really good in those films and makes those films worth seeing. But his best work is in his native language, in films like Open Hearts and After the Wedding, which are really, really good. But here he plays this completely mute warrior who has been trapped by another tribe, and he escapes from them and goes on a voyage with these Vikings. It's kind of an existential Tarkovsky-like journey, and it's a really difficult film to get a hold of, especially because his performance completely exists in the physicality. He basically has to act through acts of savage violence, and there's nothing for him to grasp in terms of dialogue. It's all in the face, all in the body, and it's a film that I find difficult to describe, and a performance I find difficult to describe, but it kind of harks back to the Silent Age, if you can imagine a kind of intensely violent Norseploitation art house movie being made in the 1930s. And I know that's difficult to kind of think about, but that's what it is, and he's absolutely brilliant. Then my first pick is Gary Oldman in a really underrated crime film from the early 90s called State of Grace, which also stars Sean Penn in one of his earlier roles. He's very good in that film as well. But it's kind of a Martin Scorsese-ish crime movie set in Boston about a man coming home and rejoining his friend, the friend being played by Gary Oldman. And he's kind of this loose cannon in a crime family who's trying to work his way up the ladder. And he's kind of... I suppose a loose cannon is the best way to describe him. He drinks and he goes out and he doesn't really have any control over what he does. He doesn't take orders from his brother well. And it's just a really energetic performance, which I know Gary Oldman is known for anyway. If you look at his work, something like Leon, which is a terrifically unhinged portrayal of madness, basically. This is a really interesting performance because it's another bad guy. He's really good at playing bad guys, but it all kind of rests on his ability to make it believable, to ground it, because he really goes over the top sometimes, especially in Leon, and he completely grounds it, completely makes it real, has great chemistry with Sean Penn, this great friendship, and by the end, when he starts doing other dealings and loses his way, you really start to feel sorry for him. And I found it a very empathetic performance. And even though the story is so wild and you just watch it for the flashiness and the style, I really found myself hooked to this character just because of the emotion that he displayed. And it's a really solid piece of work. And I know he's known as a great actor, but this is a performance that's kind of slipped through the cracks. And I really want people to go back and reevaluate both the film and him in it because he's so, so good.
Yeah, I agree completely. I mean, like,
I agree,
he's one of my favorite actors, and I just, that film I think is fantastic, and his performance is fantastic, and he's definitely the standout in that film for me.
I'm pretty sure sorry.
No, carry on. I was just going to say, I mean, I think all the performances in that film are really good, actually. Ed Harris is in it too, and John C. Reilly has a small part, but Gary Oldman just steals every frame. He's pure energy. It's just visceral, out there, but so grounded. Fantastic.
Yeah, I was going to say, I think I've seen State of Grace, but I certainly haven't seen it for probably 10 years. But I do have it kicking around on DVD, so I may well put it on after we finish here. Because you've really sold it to me there, sir. And I've been dying to see The Passion of Darkly Noon for years, and I cannot fucking get a copy.
Yeah, and like I said, it's hard to get hold of, but it's really worth paying the money for it. It's mad as a bag of frogs and just brilliant.
Yeah, that doesn't surprise me at all.
And Babe, your turn, mate.
My turn.
Your turn.
It's my turn now.
Yeah.
Awesome. Okay. Okay, my first pick, as my honorable mention, so I have to say, it's from a film I actually saw recently. That's Christopher Lloyd in 20 Bucks. In the movie, like, everyone sort of knows Christopher Lloyd.
I remember this movie.
Sort of like, yeah.
Sorry. I'm like, oh my God, I remember this movie, but continue. Sorry.
Well, I actually saw it recently for the first time. It's sort of a dramedy that sort of follows pretty much follows the lines of you know, all these sort of interconnected stories that are somehow linked together by a $20 note that sort of like comes out from the bank and sort of goes, passes on from person to person and all that, and we sort of get involved in, you know, it's each of the people's lives in this film. And but one of the subplots in particular I found really interesting was one that had Christopher Lloyd. And Christopher, this is actually quite a very different role for Christopher Lloyd, because, you know, everyone sort of knows him as, you know, Doc Brown in the Back to the Future movies and other ones, where he sort of plays sort of off-kilter kind of characters and all that. But this one, he's very, he plays it, he plays a character named Jimmy, and he's what I like to call a gentleman robber, because he sort of wanders around, he's got the good suit and everything like that. And what happens in his subplot, he sees Steve Buscemi, who's in the film, trying to rip off this diner, you know, and so he meets up and basically says, oh, you know, you kind of suck as trying to scam people, why don't you, you know, I'll take you under my wing and I'll show you the ropes and all that. So we just basically follow them around. And just during the course of the movie, like I said, he really sort of, there's none of that sort of ham or sort of over-the-topness you've seen in other films. And yeah, his character is very smart. He's very, he sort of always thinks a couple of steps ahead of him. Like he calculates everything, like whatever kind of heist they go, he's thinking of. And just more robberies, like going into liquor stores or corner stores and all that, and how he robs them, and what, he's very much in control of the situations. He knows exactly what to do. And yeah, it's a really terrific performance from him. And it just really took me aback on how actually, because he's all, like, I've always known him as a great actor anyway, but it was just really interesting to see him try something that was so against his type of, you know, characters that he usually plays. And he's absolutely wonderful in this film. And he actually did win an Independent Spirit Award for Best Supporting Actor for the film. So yeah, he's amazing in the film and definitely worth checking out. My second pick is from a performance from my favorite movie from last year, Animal Kingdom, Sutherland Stapleton, who plays the character of Craig. And in the movie, he's part of this sort of criminal family, and he's sort of like, but his character, he's like the drug addict family. And he sort of sells drugs on the side, but he's very addicted to his own stuff. But then after sort of when, like, again, not to spoil anything that happens, a tragedy that happens in the family, he and his brothers decide to go revenge against the cops. And then afterwards, him and his brothers get picked up and questioned. But he starts to get really paranoid about, because he's... nephew, who's played by James Frenchville, he was also into questioning as well, and he and his brothers are sort of discussing on whether he's going to like rat on them or not, and he starts to get really paranoid, and he thinks that the cops and everybody is coming after him, and his performance is so believable and so heartbreaking, and because you see him, this, like in one scene in particular, he decides to hide out at a friend's place outside the city, but when he gets there, it's where his paranoia reaches his peak. He thinks there's the police are listening in to their phone calls. They think the house is bugged and everything, and it's just so heartbreaking to watch. And like, even though there's a lot of amazing performances in that film, but it was his performance that really stood out for me. And he's not in the movie much, but he just stands out in every scene that he is in. So Sutherland Stapleton, another great turn, a great performance from him that's, you know, worth checking out. It's because Animal Kingdom is an awesome movie and you should check it out. And my final honorable mention is, this is actually my one and only female pick of my group, which is, like, I had a couple other female picks, but I thought I'd talk about this one in particular because her performance isn't really talked about as much. I'd have to say Laura Dern in Citizen Ruth. I saw the film a few years ago, and she sort of, and again, she, like Sutherland Stapleton, she plays a crack addict, and she, but she finds out she's pregnant, and then she's pregnant, and then she decides to, like, it's been a while since I've seen the movie, so I'm trying to remember how it went. I've got the Wikipedia page up. So I should have read this before I started talking about it. So she decides, but then she gets involved with this whole sort of pro-life versus pro-choice debate, because she wants to, doesn't want to have the kid, but all the pro-lifers are, you've got to have this kid and all that because, you know, killing kids is wrong. But then the pro-choicers are basically telling, oh, it's her right to, you know, do whatever she wants. And she keeps going back and forth between which shots. She'll be like going with the pro-choicers because, you know, basically they make a lot of good points, and then she goes to the pro-lifers at one point because they offer her money to give, to keep the baby and all that. And it's a really funny and very interesting sort of satirical look at that sort of debate. And her character, she's just absolutely fantastic in the movie. She really inhabits the character so much. And it's a hilarious performance as well. And it's kind of a shame that it doesn't get talked about, because this is the kind of performance that could be award-worthy. But Laura Dern, fantastic in Citizen Roof, and it's a great film as well, so that's definitely worth checking out as well.
Interesting choices.
I'm a massive Laura Dern fan, as everyone who loves cinema should be, I think. And I haven't seen Citizen Roof because it's incredibly hard to get, and I've still never been able to get my hands on a copy. I'm dying to see it. It's the one, you know, sort of big thing that I'm missing from her filmography. But she's a phenomenal actress and consistently underrated as well. Inland Empire, I think, is worth mentioning here. Rambling Rose is also tremendous.
I saw Rambling Rose a few months ago, and I have to agree, she was amazing in that film as well. And also, I want to mention We Don't Live Here Anymore, which she was also fantastic as well.
Yeah, I didn't like that film, but she's really, really good in it.
So anyways, that's all for my honourable mentions. So unless anyone else wants to mention any of my other picks.
I haven't seen any of them. I haven't seen any of the films, but I can only echo the love for Laura Dern, who I think is really terrific. I think she's really good in Wild at Heart as well. I think that's probably my favourite performance by her. Yeah. And Christopher Lloyd is a really great actor who I think... is kind of only seen as Doc Brown now, which is a real shame, because he did turn in some interesting performances in other films. I haven't seen 20 Bucks, but you've sold it to me. It sounds pretty interesting, so I'm going to go and see that.
It is actually a really interesting film. I mean, it's been a while since I've seen it, but yeah. I mean, it's funny because you mentioned it. I'm like, oh, yeah, wow, I remember that movie.
I'm surprised Mike hasn't seen it, though, because Melora Walters is in it, actually. I know how big a fan you are of Magnolia, so...
It's my favourite film, and I love Melora Walters. She's so underrated. And actually, that film has a really good cast, full stop. Like, you mentioned Steve Buscemi's in it, Brendan Fraser's in it. I really need to see that film. I'm gonna buy it right now, actually. So, thank you for that.
No problem. Hey, Marcy, any mentions on my picks?
I was going to choose Laura Dern as one of my main picks. So, you kind of stole her from me, which I should have actually shown you my list, but I sort of kept rearranging it. But I guess...
that's all right.
I guess I could sort of continue to talk about it because it's a different performance. If we just want to, like, head off into our main picks for discussion.
That would seem logical.
All right. I'll go first. Laura Dern. she's one of my favorite actresses. And she has appeared in a certain favorite director of mine, like quite a few of his movies. And the one that I really think was fantastic, and it really, I think, sort of really got me into being like a huge fan of hers. And I really, like when this film's mentioned, I don't really see a lot of people giving her the praise that she deserves. And I'll be talking about Wild at Heart as Lula. And I think, it's so hard for me to talk about David Lynch because I love all his work, blah, blah, blah. But this film is, I guess this is one of my all-time favorite movies as a, all of his. It's such a strange kind of crazy love story. And her character is, it's sort of like, she's kind of innocent or not exactly being innocent in this strange way. And she has this great chemistry with Nicolas Cage. And as crazy as he is, and as crazy as the story is, she manages to just still stick out and put on this fantastic performance and just have so much heart, you know, within the film. And I think it's really interesting that David Lynch has, you know, worked with her quite often, because I think they make a great team. And that sort of really went on to, I guess, go full circle with, like, Inland Empire, because she was, like, the real main focus point. But I think that this film just really sort of matured her as an actress, and it's something just extremely memorable for me, and I absolutely love her in it. And I really don't think she gets enough credit, I mean, with anything she does, but this in particular, I think she's just amazing. And I don't know if you guys want to add anything to this particular performance, but you're quite welcome to do so.
Yeah, I mean, I mentioned it just now, but I really love Wild at Heart. I think it's a great film, and I think Laura Dern is fantastic in it, as is Nicolas Cage. And I love their final scene together. I'm not going to spoil the film for anyone that hasn't seen it, but it involves a traffic jam, running in a snakeskin jacket, and just the most beautiful embrace you've ever seen. It's just it's weird calling the film beautiful, because it's kind of in a mini review that I wrote, I called it a hyper violent psychosexual fairy tale, and it's got kind of bits of The Wizard of Oz hanging over it, as I suppose a lot of Lynch does. But yeah, it's just a really memorable performance, really brave, really intense, really believable, charismatic. Everything about it is just fantastic. I love that film.
Yeah, I love her in it too. I mean, I think there are three things really that stand out for me in it. The first you mentioned is the chemistry between her and Nick Cage. And connected to that, just how she's so fucking sexy in that movie, it's got to be said. And also, there's that great scene, that insanely creepy scene with Willem Dafoe, which is... I mean, great work from both of them, but I think her reactions are what really make that scene so sort of skin-crawling as it is. But, I mean, we've said it earlier, she's just a brilliant actress, and while Wild at Heart is not my favourite of her work, I still think Inland Empire is the best thing she'll ever do. She is... Yeah, you know, just fantastic in it, as she is in most things. Yeah.
I even though I was mixed on Wild at Heart, but I do agree she was very good in that film. And even though I didn't like her, really didn't like Inland Empire, she was like one of the only good things about that movie as well.
Yeah, so, well, you be quiet.
Yeah, we really are going to fall out, Bede. If we haven't already, I've lost track.
I could say more, but, you know, I don't want to, you know, piss people off.
Yeah. Who would anyway, like to go next?
I can go. I don't mind.
I love how everyone's silent. Like, it's like in class. All right, who's going first? Nobody? All right, then teacher will pick. But Sam, yeah, go ahead.
Okay. I'm going to start with what I think is maybe one of the most unexpected performances that we're going to be talking about on this list, and that's Hayden Christensen.
What?
You know, Mannequin Skywalker.
Mannequin.
In Shattered Glass.
Oh, well, yeah.
Which is a tremendously good film by an American director called Billy Ray, who is really establishing himself as somebody interesting. But Shattered Glass is a real story about a journalist, 24-year-old journalist named Stephen Glass, played by Hayden Christensen, who was working at the New Republic magazine in the late 90s. And just after a new editor came in, one of his stories was exposed as a complete fraud. He just made it up. And it was eventually discovered that he had been doing this for a very long time, and that at least, I think, 16 of the 40 articles that he wrote for the magazine had either been completely or partially fabricated. And it's a film stuffed with amazing actors. Okay, Peter Sarsgaard, Melanie Lynskey, who, by the way, could be in this list for just about any performance she's ever given.
Yeah.
Chloe Sevigny, Rosario Dawson, Steve Zahn, you know, all of these people, Hank Azaria, all these people in one movie, and then leading it, anchoring it, you've got Hayden Christensen. But he's great. He's fantastically
he
good
is.
In it.
He really is.
Playing this kind of, he's such a weak character, Stephen Glass. I think that's what defines him. And Christensen plays him as this sweaty, oozy, wormy little guy who is, you know, perpetually afraid of things, I think. You know, he's forever looking for validation. And that seems to be where the making up the stories comes from. You know, this this joy that he seems to take in the weekly editors' meetings where all of his pitches go over gangbusters because he's making them up. And it's a fantastically layered performance as well, because you see the levels of deceit that he's, you know, built in, the way he believes in what the fictions that he's spinning, and also is willing to take people to task for not getting their facts straight. It's an incredibly layered piece of work, and really makes the draws the movie together in a big way, because, you know, if you don't have that center point, I don't care how good the actors around him had been, or how good the rest of the film is, it just wasn't going to work, and he completely sells it. I don't know anything very much about the real Stephen Glass and what he was like, but you totally buy into that characterization. And given the work that he's turned in before and after this, it seems like such a total anomaly, but it's a performance that's well worth seeing. I don't know if anyone else has seen it. Well, no, I do.
I think it's a terrific film, and he's such a revelation in it. It's just, it literally blew me away. There's these fantastic moments where the Peter Sarsgaard character, who becomes the editor about a quarter of the way into the film, takes him to task about one particular story, and they go out to the locations of where this story supposedly happened, where the things went down. And there are just so many shots on the Hayden Christensen character trying to justify himself, making things up. And it's just like watching a man crawl into himself and die with just these such conflicted emotions. He so desperately wants to save himself, but he's drowning. And he's, you know, like you say, it's a sweaty, oozy performance. He just, it's so incredible to watch those scenes where he's just stood there, just falling in on himself, just becoming the shadow of himself. It's so powerful. He's a fantastic, he's not a fantastic actor, but I do think that he has the potential to be brilliant because of what I've seen in this film. He's just amazing. Mm-hmm.
I've never seen him give another performance of worth, but this is enough to convince me he's got them in him.
It's not that I haven't seen him give another performance of worth, it's just that I haven't seen him give another one as good as this.
Yeah, it's definitely the best thing he has ever done, and this is a fantastic film, and he is really fantastic in him, and I almost wish he would just take on unexpected roles like this, just kind of, you know, move away from the whole Star Wars thing and, you know, not head into that territory and show us, like, you know, he can do this stuff.
But he did, Marcy. He was in Jumper, duh. That was, like, a revelation of a performance.
Oh, my God. The Jumper. Fantastic.
Oh, and Awake.
Oh, God, Awake. Yeah, and it's like, that is not what we are feeling. The audience had the opposite reaction to what it wanted to sell. It was like, Awake? No, I've been asleep the whole time.
Absolutely. I mean, That was a self-reviewing movie, if ever I'd heard one, seen one.
Yeah.
Awake, asleep.
Yeah. Terrible. God.
But yeah, Shattered Glass is stunning, and Hayden Christensen's great in it. So, you know, if you haven't seen it, do track it down, check it out, because it'll be a rewarding 80-85 minutes for you, I promise.
I feel like watching it again now, actually. all right, we'll go.
Well, we've got some stuff to do first, but yeah.
Yeah. Bede, I'll throw it to you, buddy.
Alrighty. My first pick is Val Kilmer in The Doors.
Okay.
Which is Val Kilmer. Like, I saw this last year, I think. And this performance, when I saw it for the first time, I was absolutely astonished by his performance in this film. I mean, I love Val Kilmer. He's a great actor. I have no idea why the hell he's looking like Marlon Brando these days, but, you know, that's a whole different story altogether. Oh, but and why he's, like, in movies with 50 Cent, but, again, that's a whole different story altogether. But back in the 90s, he sort of did a lot of really interesting performances and all that, but I think his performance as Jim Morrison in The Doors is definitely, like, one of the best things he has ever done. And I think it's actually up there as one of the great performances of the 90s. He really, saying what you will about the film, I personally love the film, but, you know, a lot of people sort of mix on it, but I can't find any fault with his performance in it. He just dies in the role with all of his heart and soul, and he actually becomes Jim Morrison. I mean, the fact that he does even look like Jim Morrison is kind of astonishing in of itself, but he really inhabits the character in every single part, from, you know, just the whole drug crazes that he's going through and just his performances. I mean, his, just like the concert performances are fucking amazing. Like, he just really sells it. And also, he did his own singing in the movie as well, which helps as well. And I can't... It's an absolutely brilliant performance by him, and I don't know why it has gone unnoticed. Like, the movie still sort of has a cult reputation now, but I don't know how on earth his performance sort of went by a lot of people. It's astonishing. It really is, and it's definitely up there as one of the best performances I have ever seen on film. And it's whether you like the movie or not, like I said before, but it's just definitely worth checking out just to see him. Because he's just absolutely flawless. And that's basically it.
That's all you have to say about that, apparently.
Yeah.
Yeah. I'm not a Val Kilmer fan, per se, but I do agree that he's good in The Doors. In fact, I think he's... did turn in a couple of really good performances in the 90s. A really underrated one as well is a film we did with Michael Douglas, The Ghost in the Darkness, which is really good. But he's fine in The Doors. I don't have quite as much love for that film or his performance as you do, but it's just got a Blu-ray release here in the UK. If you're going to see it that way. And it is a pretty solid performance.
Well, I think it's...
Yeah, again...
Sorry.
I was just going to say, again, it's been a while since I've seen it, but I remember being much more impressed by Val Kilmer than I was by the film. I think, you know, there's a lot of Oliver Stone's worst successes at work in The Doors, you know, and some of his sillier running themes, you know, the Indian and the snake and all that bullshit.
I think that was really intentional, to be honest, to get the whole drug scene and all that, just trying to make it as psychedelic. It's basically like, until you saw like Fear and Loathing in Las Vegas, this is what this movie would look like if you were on drugs. Well, that's what I assume.
But yeah, I mean, that doesn't feel like Jim Morrison's experience. That feels like Oliver Stone indulging himself to me. But the performance, you're right, is terrific. And there are times that he is eerily like Jim Morrison. In that movie. If I were going to pick an underrated Val Kilmer performance, though, I'd have gone with Kiss Kiss Bang Bang.
Yeah, that's great.
You know, but there we go.
Yeah.
I haven't seen the film for ages, Sorry, I haven't seen the film for ages, so I can't really comment on the film, but I do remember thinking Val Kilmer was pretty awesome in that film, and I mean, it's hard to really say, because, like, he had so much going for him, and then so much went wrong. But, like, some of those earlier films, like this and or Tombstone, he was fantastic. And, like, as you said, more recently, like, Kiss Kiss Bang Bang.
And he was in, actually.
Huh?
And Bad Lieutenant as well. He had a small part in Bad Lieutenant. And people forget that he was in Heat as well.
Oh, fuck, yeah, totally.
And, yeah, as I said...
the biggest film of the 90s.
Mm.
David Mamet's film Spartan recently as well.
Yeah, he's good in that.
Have not seen
it. Actually, I have to admit, my all-time favourite Val Kilmer performance is his very first performance in Top Secret.
Yes, but we know that that film changed your life, Bede.
It did. It's, like, one of the greatest comedies ever made, man.
Yes, it made an honourable mention on Films That Changed My Life podcast.
Exactly, because it like, made me realise that Val Kilmer was, like, totally awesome.
That was a life-changing experience. Actually, no, that could be a life-changing experience. Yeah.
That
could be what derailed him.
Amazing. Well, that was his first movie, so...
Yeah, no,
it's great.
Batman.
No, I think Batman was, I think, was kind of the down.
That's definitely where it did.
No, I think it was McDonald's that derailed him, personally, but, you know, that's his
movie. McDonald's!
It is... People always say, like, people say Angelina Jolie needs a burger. I think somebody needs to stop giving Val Kilmer burgers right now.
Yeah, he is kind of acting
Val Kilmer. So,
yes, so Val Kilmer in the Doors.
Val Kilmer in the Doors, everybody.
Check it out if you haven't seen it.
Alrighty, over to Mike for his first honorable mention. I mean, his first pick.
First pick is Emil Jannings in a old 1920s German film, which in the Western world is known as The Last Man or The Last Laugh. People forget, I think, that Emil Jannings was the first person to ever win a Best Actor Oscar. And I think he's largely forgotten now. And in fact, I don't think there's really enough appreciation for silent movie acting anymore. I mean, that's kind of understandable given how far down the line we are now and how long it's been since silent cinema was popular, although it's still made by directors like Sylvain Chomet and Guy Maddin. And this is just a really terrific performance. The film is best remembered for the technical innovations. This is pretty much where the tracking shot was born, with kind of experiments. I think one scene, the first shot is a character going down an elevator and then walking out into the lobby of a hotel. And it was achieved by just putting a camera in a pram and just rolling it along the floor. Things as simple as that, just establishing movement within cinema, that started here. And that really overshadows a fantastic performance by Emil Jannings, who plays an aging doorman of this hotel who is fired, basically because he's too old. And he lives in kind of a rundown area, but his job is seen as quite high class. He's respected by the people, and he's ashamed to go home because he feels that they will look down on him and equally pity him and mock him, and he doesn't want either of those things. He wants to keep his stature. There are some fantastic effects in the film. There's a scene where he's walking away from the hotel, and a special effect allows the hotel to kind of tower over him and just dwarf him, basically, and make him feel completely belittled and emotionally dead. But the whole performance completely takes place in his physicality. In fact, this was the first film I saw Emil Jannings in, and he's quite overweight, quite bulking, and I thought that was what he looked like. But actually, it's all makeup. He put on basically like a fat suit and arched his back, and it's incredible that I look at other films and that's not his physicality at all. It wasn't just the makeup, it was the way he got into the role, the way he inhabited the skin of that character. And he just kind of hobbles around and just looks really sad and weathered all the time. And it's so easy to kind of do that in a cloying way that panders to the audience, just, you know, the doe-eyed performance. But he really invests this character with the feeling of a life having been lived in. And what happens in the end is he goes back to the hotel and tries to get his job back, but he gets sent down into the washroom, and he's the guy who hands over the towels to the rich businessmen who come through, and he has to kind of watch his life, the life that he never had, be lived out through them on a day-to-day basis. And the final shot of the film, or at least where the film ends for me, because there's a really tacky, optimistic ending put onto the end because the production company thought that the ending was too bleak. The first ending of the film sees him just sat in the corner of this washroom holding a towel, and the frame slowly zooms out as this shadow envelopes him, and it's just so heartbreaking, not just because it's fantastically directed and the innovations of the tracking shot allows you to feel that, but because you just feel this distance drawing between you and the character, and you want to hold on to him, you want to go into the frame and help him and give him, you know, some money and say, get your life back, you know, become the person you wanted to be, but you can't. You just become more and more distant from him, and it's a towering performance, but you'd never know it because it's so underplayed, so understated, completely exists behind the eyes, completely exists in the physicality and just the sadness of this man, the way he arches himself over and goes through life not really looking at anything or taking anything in. It's heartbreaking and fantastic, and people really need to see it.
I think I will after that.
You and I have talked about this film before, Mike, and
I should say it's one of my favourites of all time.
I've been desperate to see it since before we talked about it, even more so since we've talked about it. Obviously, I haven't seen this one, but I will agree with you on the point about silent film acting in general. I think, you know, it is sometimes of a style, but there are actors who even then were doing stuff that is more subtle and more modern. I think of Lillian Gish in particular, who I've seen in a few things and was, you know, clearly a wonderful actress and had an 80 plus year career.
Sure.
Just, you know, terrific stuff. So yeah, I mean, I would definitely agree with you on that principle, but I really need to see this, yeah.
And is that it?
Like, silent films, I'd say silent films are sort of making the comeback now, because a silent film that was released at the Cannes Film Festival this year actually won the Best Actor Award.
The Artist.
And I saw the trailer for that, and it looks amazing.
Yeah, I mean, like I said, silent cinema isn't dead. Sylvain Chomet and Guy Madden is doing fantastic work in the area. But those films aren't exactly popular, nor indeed do I think The Artist will be when it finally gets released. I just think people don't look on it with the respect that it deserves.
Probably, but the Weinsteins have picked it up, so you can imagine what kind of campaign they can do for that film.
Oh, sure. There's going to be a full-on Oscar campaign and everything, yeah.
I think it's a different language in a certain way. I mean, silent cinema is like picking up another language for modern cinephiles. I think, you know, as you're getting into it. But like learning a language, I think it's incredibly rewarding and enriching. And it's something that I'm aiming to explore much more of, because, yeah, the trips I've taken with it so far have been very rewarding.
It's a whole different style of acting as well. It's more in tune with theatre, because theatre acting and film acting are very different things. Silent acting is obviously more expressive. That's why comedy was so popular. That's why Chaplin and Keaton and Lloyd were such big stars, because they were able to do that sort of pratfalling thing. And there is a tendency to overplay, as you mentioned, with silent acting. But yeah, Emil Jannings for me was really the king of the understatement in the silent era. I think that's why he got Best Actor when he did. I think that's why he was the first to be rewarded, and I think that's apt for him. It's such a subtle performance in an era where it was all about showmanship and, you know, exaggeration. I urge people to see this film.
Will do.
Cool.
All right, we'll go back to me, I guess. So I'll go with my number two on my three. I've decided to go with Clifton Collins Jr. in Capote, which obviously it's a pretty well-known film. It won Philip Seymour Hoffman a Best Actor Oscar. But for me, the film was all about him. It was all about Philip Seymour Hoffman. And I think, you know, the thing that for me, I mean, this stood out more than his performance was Clifton Collins Jr. as Perry, who is he's kind of the center of what, you know, Truman Capote went and did, whereas he met this guy who with another fella had gone and killed this family. And he was with talking with him and, you know, all the stuff that they would do. I mean, it was this guy that sort of really got him into this case and everything there. And, you know, there was so much with that character having, I guess, to come across as sympathetic in a way that made it so that, you know, us as the audience could sort of understand why Capote had such a fascination. And I think Clifton Collins Jr. was just, you know, he really made Perry a sympathetic character, which I guess is not easy to do. Because, you know, obviously there was another film made about the same thing at the same time called Infamous, and Daniel Craig played that role. And while he was good, he just didn't have, you know, the same chops that, or, you know, he didn't bring the same thing that Clifton Collins Jr. did to the role. And he really floored me with his performance and how he just portrayed this character. And, you know, I mean, before this movie, I'd seen Clifton Collins in a few things and he'd always been very memorable, but this is the one that really just set it off for me. And I just absolutely love the guy. I think he's a great actor, and I really wish that, you know, there would have been more attention put on him for his performance in the movie. And I think some of, like, Philip Seymour Hoffman's best work in the film is when he's doing scenes with Clifton Collins. So I just think he's such an underrated actor, and this is maybe, you know, the best performance I have seen of his. And I really think that he's someone who definitely deserves recognition. And that's my little Clifton Collins Jr. love fest.
I think he's a really good actor as well, actually. Definitely underrated. I think the last thing we saw him in was as one half of the vegan police in Scott Pilgrim with Thomas Jane,
brilliant.
Which was a funny little cameo.
Yeah, it was brilliant.
But yeah, he turns up in loads of films, some good, some terrible. But yeah, he's always really engaging, really great, really interesting actor, I guess.
Yeah, he really is.
I think something interesting about him is obviously he kind of started off in those sort of stereotype parts, you know, the gang member, the gang leader. I mean, notably 187, which was his debut, I think. He has that kind of very stereotypical role, but he's really broken out of that and become a very fine character actor.
Definitely.
I liked him a lot in Sunshine Cleaning. I think he was very effective there with Amy Adams.
I mean, for me, like, I see him in something and it could be a really terrible film, but he's just, he really brings it no matter what. Like, he can turn it around. And at least if he's in a bad movie, he can at least come out not stinking like shit, basically. Would be a good way to put it. But yeah, I mean, his performance in Capote just, I mean, it floored me. I thought he was fantastic. I cried watching him perform because he was that good. So, I mean, what can I say? Yeah.
Yeah, not a lot more than that.
Yeah, apparently. Franco's quiet. I guess, Sam, back to you, buddy.
Well, that's interesting that you mentioned with Clifton Collins that he can, you know, be in a crappy movie and come out kind of smelling of roses, because that's also a trait common to Nina Hirst, who's the German actress I want to talk about quickly next. And I'm cheating a bit here because what I really want to do is say Nina Hirst in everything I've ever seen her in.
everything I've ever seen her in.
I've seen her in 5 movies. Her stuff doesn't often come out over here, but she is phenomenal. She's completely different, completely invisible in each of them. I've said before that if it weren't for the fact that she's got a very distinctive look, she's got a very particular sort of angular beauty about her that is very identifiable. But if it weren't for that, you wouldn't believe it was the same actress in Yella, in playing, you know, like a disaffected businesswoman, in Atomized, playing a very flighty, irresponsible parent in the 60s, in The Only Thing That Is Fun About That Movie. Or indeed, good, really, about that movie. A woman who, you know, has a seriously brutal time in the aftermath of the Second World War in Berlin in a film called Anonyma, or as the vampire queen in We Are the Night, which is opening soon in the US. You know, she's such a versatile, impressive actress, and she seems to just be sort of swallowed whole by these characters and just disappear into them. I think the two that I've been really impressed with are Anonyma, which has been, I've got to say, one of the worst sold films I've ever seen in my life. The DVD cover in the UK just makes it look like this horrendous low budget.
It looks atrocious, doesn't it?
Explodey war movie. Yeah. And it's nothing like that. It's more of a downfall like drama. About the way that the conquering Russian army treated the women of Berlin, and, you know, sort of frequently attacked and raped them, and the way that some women decided to try and protect themselves. And a film called The Heart is a Dark Forest, which has never had a proper release, but I saw at Bird's Eye View Film Festival. And that's a tremendous sort of surreal movie about a woman who goes on this kind of surreal journey when she finds out that her husband actually has another family across town and has been living this double life. And there are, you know, shades of Eyes Wide Shut to that. And but again, what really just strikes me about her every time is I can't believe it's the same actress. You know, I have I'm developing a similar kind of relationship with her as I have to Isabelle Huppert or Jennifer Jason Leigh, which is just to be awed every time I see her, that she's quite so different and quite so good. I mean, We Are the Night, which is the thing that most people will probably first see her in, because it's going to be quite a populist thing. Isn't her best work. She plays a lesbian vampire queen, and, you know, it's quite broad work, but she does it, you know, with a great deal of reality, and you believe in the relationship somewhat. But, you know, if you want to see her do properly great dramatic work, Anonyma, The Heart is a Dark Forest, and even though I don't actually like the film, it's a bit over obvious, Yella is a terrific performance as well. So Nina Hirst, you can't go wrong, really.
I will need to discover her, apparently.
As will I. Yeah. I'm desperately behind on everything she's done, but I plan on picking up Anonyma as soon as possible on Blu-ray, even though that cover is just awful and has put me off buying it ever since it came out. But yeah, I'll definitely give it a shot.
I think you would like Yella a lot as well, actually, mate.
Yeah, I mean, I want to watch that as well. I'll get around to all of it at some point and let you know what I think.
Cool.
Yeah, I'll have to give her a watch. I mean, you rarely steer me wrong, sir, so...
Do my best.
Yes. But no, I think you've sold me to check her out, definitely. Bede, any comments?
Yeah, I will. I'd have to check those movies out too. This is like the first time I've actually heard of it, so So I do, if I see any of those movies coming out, I'll make sure to check them out.
Bea, do you want to have your shot?
Alrighty. My turn. Okay. My next pick would have to be a performance from one of my favourite actors, and that is Kevin Bacon in The Woodsman.
Yeah, solid choice. Can't argue with it.
Fantastic.
Please walk us through it. Well,
yes.
Yeah.
Well, Kevin Bacon, who it plays Walter, who is a convicted child molester, and after sort of serving time in prison, he's sort of let back into society, and he tries to get on with his life, and you know, like after you know, trying to get back on, you know, get everything back on. That is life, but you know, it's just I'm trying to explain the movie. he sort of tries to get his life back on track, but you know, the circumstances what he did in the past keep coming back to haunt him. There's one in particular where there's a cop played by Mos Def, who comes throughout the movie, like every now and again during the movie, sort of basically harassing him and basically say, "Oh, if you screw up, I'm so gonna, you know, put your ass back in jail and stuff like that." And he tries to move on with his life. You know, he's trying to find work and even develops a relationship with a woman who's named Vicky, who is also played by Kevin Bacon's real life wife, Kira Sedgwick. But of course, you know, and he thinks that he's cured of his disease, but His temptations start coming back, where he starts to those urges that he develops all the time, and he's trying to he tries his hardest not to fall back into that old life of being a child molester, and how he plays it in the movie, from the get go, it's hard to at first you don't want to sympathize with him because, you know, he is a child molester and child molesters are like the scum of the earth and they should be shot. I mean, that's just my personal opinion. But what he does with the performance, he really brings a lot of empathy to the character. So you can really see... So at the same... Because he knows that... Bacon knows that this is a character you're not supposed to truly sympathize with it because it'd be... to especially what he did, but he still gives us enough information with the character to really still empathize with him, to know like what he's going through, and he's trying to, like I said, get his life back on track and try to have a normal life so he can fit into society. But at times it doesn't work quite as well as he wants it to, and he just does it so beautifully. He really has it. It could have easily, like I said, it could have easily have been a really disturbing role, but he does it in a way that is heartbreaking and quite tragic, especially where his character goes through. And I have to commend the director, Nicole Castle, who also co-wrote the script, for making this type of film, because like I can understand people being very uncomfortable by this film, and I have to admit, even at times I was too, especially certain scenes where sort of Kevin Bacon, it's like he's walking along and he sees kids and he starts, you know, getting certain urges and all that, and he's trying, you know, desperately not to think about, you know, that stuff. But he does. But both the director and Kevin Bacon somehow do make it work. So it makes a really interesting, very compelling character study of this character of Walter. And Kevin Bacon is just phenomenal in this film. It's definitely one of the great performances of his career. And I have to commend Kevin Bacon that he's a very fearless actor. Like, he is not afraid to tackle any role that comes his way. I mean, this is actually what's interesting. This is actually Master's second time that he's played like a child molester or a child abuser in a film, because he previously played one in the film Sleepers. But that character was like even though he was great in that film, but that was more like the truly evil, disgusting bad guy. But this one, it's the complete opposite, where you see this guy in his daily struggles to have a normal life. But it just, doesn't work as easy as he wants it to, and he's held up by a great supporting cast. Besides Kira Sedgwick from Oz, it has Benjamin Bratt as his brother-in-law, who's like the only person from his life before he went to jail that's still in contact with him. Mm. And of course, Eve and even Michael Shannon is in the film as well.
Oh my so god, he is.
Yeah.
Wow.
I only just read it on the Wikipedia page.
Oh, you're funny.
So it's definitely a film I actually saw it a long time ago. So there are some certain things I am a bit fuzzy about, but just some of the strong elements that stood out for me, definitely I would have to go back and check it at some point. And it's really interesting how the movie plays, because just it didn't help with his character. He's, like I said before, he's trying to get his life back on track, but it didn't help that the apartment, and I can't remember if it was chosen for him or if he picked it out, is across the road.
I think it was given to him, like they said he had to live there, I'm pretty sure.
Yeah, so I think maybe it might have been, I keep thinking, just sort of thinking about it now, maybe whether it's something like a test to see if he can be not normal again. You know, having that sort of, you know, kids, a playground across the road, like in his face all the time. But it's definitely a really fascinating film, and it's an amazing performance, and it's a shame that nobody really talks about it. But I suppose it's really the subject matter that kind of has kept people from seeing it, because, I mean, it is a movie about a child molester, and like I said, it's definitely kind of that kind of subject really is very it's too disturbing for some people. But I think if people give it a chance and see this truly phenomenal performance, they'll see that it's actually a lot more than just, you know, a child molester movie.
Yeah, I mean, it's actually, I thought it was a really well-made and just an interesting look at, you know, that subject matter. And his performance was really, I mean, it was something else. He was fantastic. And it was very moving. The movie was very upsetting. And, I mean, I think Kevin Bacon as an actor is very underrated. I mean, when he does something like this, I think it really goes unnoticed.
And he's delivered a lot of great performances.
I mean,
whether it's in big films or smaller films, he always delivers. I mean, just like shout out other little good performances, like JFK, but he started as pretty much a heartthrob actor.
Yeah.
And it's just during the course of his career that he decided to become more of a character actor. Mm. And, yeah, he's definitely one of the great actors who should have been nominated for an Oscar by now, but hopefully one day he will. But it's definitely one of the great actors working today, Kevin Bacon. So, yeah.
it's a character that would be very easy to play in a certain way. You know, it's very easy to take that character, Walter, and play him as a monster. And that's why Kevin Bacon's so impressive in The Woodsman, because he plays him as a person.
Exactly.
You know, with flaws and problems, but also with qualities that are laudable that come out in his relationship with Kira Sedgwick's character. Mm. You know, And there are moments where you go, where you see him as a nice guy and you want to root for him. And I think there is a rooting for him to get over his, you know, the things that he's struggling with as well. But also, the film isn't afraid to confront the fact that he still has these urges. And that's a brave thing for the film and for the performance. I think it's a beautifully judged piece of work on both levels.
Mm.
Yeah.
It presents it as it is. It's not saying, you know, it's not being like, oh, this is how it is, this is how it is. No, it's just, this is the story. I'm not trying to give you any kind of opinion one way or the other.
It doesn't sort of take sides where this guy's a monster, or this guy, we should, you know, this guy's just suffering from a disease, we should be sympathetic towards him. That's why it sort of has that fine line, so it doesn't go back. It's just right in the middle, so you can just sit back, look at the performance without any judgment from the filmmakers involved.
Yeah. I don't feel like I can really add any more except to say that I think the film is a tremendous brave piece of work, and Kevin Bacon is a really underrated actor. I think he's also great in a film with Colin Firth, Where the Truth Lies, which is very underrated.
Yeah, that is a really good movie.
Yeah, it's a great movie. But yeah, he's great here. Completely fearless performance, so well measured and understood and sympathetic. And there's that scene towards the end where he's on the bench with the little girl, which is just so difficult because you have so many different emotions and feelings invested in him. And I won't say how that scene goes down as a spoiler, but just that whole set piece is so difficult because he's just fantastic.
So, Mike, do you want to continue with yours?
Yeah, okay. So my second pick is an actress who I haven't seen anything else from, and apparently she's quite well appreciated in her home country, but it's, I think I'm pronouncing this right, Natalia Bondarchuk, who is the lead actress in Andrei Tarkovsky's Solaris. And the thing about Tarkovsky for me is that I'd always found him quite, much like Kubrick, very cold and clinical and removed from his characters and his storytelling. And you can't get one of his films during the first watch, really. It takes a distance to really appreciate the work. You have to let his films grow on you and envelope you, and you have to access the emotions and the ideas in them, not during the film, but separate from it. That's especially true of a film like Stalker, which I hated the first time I saw it and I love now, because you just can't get that film on the first go. Solaris, however, was very different for me. It's a film that I got straight away. And I don't know if that's because I'd seen the remake prior to the original, which is much more emotionally and thematically accessible, or whether it's just because her performance just has an emotional weight, which you don't get with any other Tarkovsky film. Basically, the film, for those who don't know, is about a man, I can't remember his name, I think his name might be Chris, but I might be wrong, who goes out to a station in space, Solaris, where odd things have been happening. Odd things as in people seeing things, people perhaps disappearing. They don't know what powers are possessed in this region of space. And basically Chris goes out there to investigate and he starts seeing perhaps images or perhaps the reality of his wife, who he thought dead or perhaps is dead. And she plays this character as just a completely lost soul floating through a space and a time that she doesn't identify with. She's lonely, doesn't understand the interaction that she now has with this man that she perhaps once knew. It's like she has to learn all over again who he is and their relationship. But also there's like the hint of manipulation going on there, that she's controlled by this force in this region of space, and that she's playing him. And there's so many different things going on, but there's one scene where, and I haven't seen the film for a while, so I might not be remembering this quite right, but she tries to kill herself, basically, because she can't keep going through what she's going through. At first, he can't handle the emotion. He leads her up to this little pod and sends her out into space because he wants to get rid of her and distance himself from these emotions. But then she comes back, which is what gives the hint of her not being real, but being a ghostly presence. And eventually, actually, the tables turn and he falls back in love with her and he becomes entranced into this spell and he wants to be with her and she can't cope with it. She can't understand these emotions that perhaps she can't even comprehend because she's not real. And she tries to kill herself and there's an amazing moment where she actually comes back to life and you just see this look in her eyes. Just this piercing look of, in a way, seeing the world and seeing the person she's with for the first time. It's a performance I find very difficult to describe, but it's really an astonishing piece of work. Completely grounds the film, gives it the emotion that Tarkovsky just doesn't have in other films, and it's so worth checking out. Yeah, so it's a really great performance, really great piece of work. Grounds it in an emotion that I don't think Tarkovsky has otherwise. So if you haven't seen it already, it's worth checking out. And I don't know what you lot think of the film and the performance.
I haven't seen it.
And has I'm very, shameful. Anyone and I, seen any Tarkovsky? Because no, I haven't.
I haven't, and I actually really want to see this, and it's just a matter of me getting my ass into gear to see it, so.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Well, I did see Solaris a long time ago, but it's been years since I've seen it, so I'm sort of vaguely from remembering.
Right, well, the remake, all of you.
And I'm very sorry.
Yeah. Yeah, I don't think the remake is as bad as some people like to make out, but, you know, it's certainly nothing compared to the original, which is a masterpiece of science fiction and film in general.
I am kind of intrigued by the idea of visiting it now, though, because I think it was quite a serious influence, along with a few other Tarkovsky films, on Antichrist, which obviously I love. So, you know, there's definitely an interest there. So
I mean, Tarkovsky has been a massive influence on pretty much every cinema that has come after him. Just the visual style, the ideas, all of it. So yeah, definitely check out Solaris. It's the easiest entry point for his work, and has that fantastic performance at the centre.
I will definitely look into it, sir.
Yes, I was going to say the exact same thing. I guess back to me for my last one. I guess keeping with a bit of a sci-fi theme, I guess. My last one is Sam Rockwell, and I guess in everything that he does, but more specifically in Moon. And Moon was basically my number one film of that year, and Sam Rockwell's performance was the, for me anyway, the number one performance for that year as well. And, you know, this guy, he can do no wrong at all. Like, As I said about Clifton Collins, I think even in the worst thing, Sam Rockwell can still come out of it, you know, fantastic. And Moon is his film. Like, he is in this thing the whole way. It's just him. It's him and a voice, basically. And, I mean, the film itself had some great ideas. It takes twists and turns, and it's very strange. It's very smart. And, you know, I think that, you know, Sam Rockwell just could really shine because it is all about him and the way that he plays different roles, I guess. Like, I honestly could have just thought it was a different actor doing it, but it was all him. And it's done so just perfectly. Like, the way that he performs it and the way that it's directed and edited and put together, I mean, I really felt like there was just two people there. It was two different actors. They just happened to look exactly the same. And I think it's a credit to him, because if I could believe it, then, you know, job well done. And I think this film, like, I know a lot of people really that did see it really liked it and thought he was great. And it's just one of those films that really went under the radar. And it just felt like it wasn't playing anywhere. I couldn't see it when I wanted to see it upon its release. I mean, the marketing was terrible. It's just like it got thrown aside and there was, you know, I guess it just kind of felt like one of those really just understated films. And at the heart of it was this fantastic performance that, you know, not a lot of people you know, would have gotten to see. I mean, it's not really like a mainstream film, but still it should have been given a chance for, you know, itself to find a wider audience, because I think it's that good and it does deserve it. And, you know, Sam Rockwell, I would give him every award under the sun for just being amazing. And Moon, I think, is just one of my favorite performances. And, you know, with all of the fantastic things he's done, I think it is maybe his best work, and that says a lot. And, I want to make love to Sam Rockwell for how awesome he is, and I'll leave it at that. So, comments ahoy.
Comments ahoy. I'm a bit lost now, because you just kind of threw me with that one.
Yeah, I'm just in a bit of a stunned silence.
Okay, do you have any comments about Sam Rockwell or Sam Rockwell in Moon without the last
Sam
little
Rockwell
bit?
Sam Rockwell is awesome to begin with.
Mm-hmm.
I was the guy who saw Moon and thought there was a bit of an Emperor's New Clothes thing happening. I really liked it for about 45 minutes, and then I figured out exactly what the rest of the film was going to be, and I was completely right, and so I kind of stopped caring.
Fair enough.
I think there are interesting things in it. His performance is chief among them, but I don't think it's as good a film as people have said it is. I kind of feel the same way about Duncan Jones' second film, actually, Source Code.
Well, what I say goes, so...
Though that's actually a much weaker film than Moon, I think.
It's not as good. I still think it's a... I mean, I still think Source Code was quite solid. I think he's still kind of finding his feet, I guess. And, I mean, I think he will be a very interesting director, and I really would like to see what he does. And
but, yeah, I mean,
you could do a lot worse than having your first film be Moon, so.
Oh, no, totally. I mean, there are, like I say, there is about half a really good movie there. I just think once you know what's going on and it's the most obvious thing that could be going on given the situation, it's, I found it underwhelming.
I don't
that
think
point.
That took away from it at all.
But,
and I was still very fascinated. I mean, I normally can figure these things out because I'm a very, very smart person.
Well, I mean, I've got to say, I had the suspicion that what is happening was what was happening from the trailer.
Yeah, the trailer, I think, kind of revealed a bit too much,
just
honestly.
From watching the movie.
Yeah, but I think the trailer did give too much away. But I thought, even with that, I thought it was very fascinating and... Just the ideas behind it were, you know, I thought were fantastic. And I really, obviously, I really loved the film. And Sam Rockwell is the man.
Oh, totally.
Sam Rockwell is great. In fact, I'm just looking through his filmography on IMDb now, and I'm seeing how much great stuff he really has done. I think my favourite performance of his, and actually probably my favourite film that he's been in, is Confessions of a Dangerous Mind, which is a really underrated film. Yeah. Really, really great. But, you know, he was also great in, you know, Matchstick Men, Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy, and those are both films I have big problems with, but he's fantastic in them. Actually, Assassination of Jesse James is one of my favourite films of all time. It's in my top 20, actually.
Agreed.
And he's great in his small role in that. Mm. Choke, Frost Nixon, he's just so good.
Lawn Dogs.
Really, I was going to say, Sam and I love the Lawn Dogs.
I haven't seen that, but I will.
That'll annoy
the shit
out of AJ.
AJ. AJ didn't finish it. His opinion doesn't count.
No, you're damn right.
And I'll send him this podcast just so he can hear us say that.
Again.
Again.
We should try and work that into every podcast.
Yeah,
we
should just blame AJ. But
after
this,
I think Sam Rockwell should just be renamed Sam Rocks Rockwell.
Sam Rocks. And he was even in Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles, and he was awesome, by the way.
Yes. Exactly.
so that's my, list for unsung performances. So I'll hand it back to Sam.
It's interesting that Marcy mentioned Tim Roth earlier, because the last film that I want to talk about is his only, to date, directorial effort, a film called The War Zone, which I rewatched this morning and is an exhausting start to any morning. It's a difficult film. It's about a family who moved to Devon, and soon after they move and the youngest child is born, the 15-year-old son discovers that his father, played by Ray Winston, and his sister, played by Laura Belmont, who is the outstanding actor here and the person I want to talk about, he discovers them having a bath together and later follows them on a walk and discovers that they are having an incestuous relationship. it's an emotionally devastating film. Thanks to all the performances, but I think particularly to Laura Belmont's, which is just so naturalistic, so grounded, so real, in every facet, in every moment, in the close relationship that she has with her younger brother, and the way that she kind of wants to take care of him, but in totally the wrong way. There's a moment when they go to London together, and she, again, I think by way of trying to take care of him in some way, tries to get him laid, and that turns out to be a complete disaster. But the relationship is really nicely drawn by the script and by her performance. But what's really impressive is just largely her silence. There's an incredible sequence towards the end of the film where her brother finally confronts her father with the fact that he knows about this relationship. And while there's a lot of shots of Ray Winston and Freddie Cunliffe playing the brother, the most interesting shots in that sequence are actually focused on Laura Belmont, who is, you know, has a head in her hands on the table and is shaking, absolutely terrified that her brother is making this revelation, because she knows what it, she can see what it's provoking her father to. And then a later scene, almost the last scene of the film, in which she confronts him with the reality of it, which we do actually see, which is, that was the moment that was cut from the R-rated version of the film in the US, was the moment that we actually see the father having sex with his daughter. And it is unfathomably upsetting and difficult. It's incredibly graphically depicted. And it's an unbelievably harsh scene. It's as difficult, I think, a rape scene as there has ever been on screen. It's up there with the scene in Irreversible for me. But it is absolutely crucial that we see it, because we have to know that this isn't something that Tom is making up, or that Jesse has imagined. And when she finally confronts her father with it, just with the words, "You fuck me." I mean, it's as brutal as anything you'll ever see or hear in a film. And the simplicity and the truth with which Laura Belmont does that and everything in the film is what really gives it its extraordinary power, because it could have been a really seedy, exploitative film, and it never is. It's yeah, I just think she's extraordinary in it, and the film itself, I think, is one of the most underseen, underrated British films of the past, well, it was made 12 years ago, so I mean the past 15, 20 years even.
It's
an astonishing piece of work. And if you'll just let me tell a quick story. I remember the first time I saw it was at a festival of British film that I went on a college trip to in Dinard in northern France. And I had recently read the book that the film is based on, and just been blown away by it. So I made basically the entire trip come with me. I was just saying, look, this is an incredible book. It's going to be a great movie. You've got to come. You've got to come and see this with me. I loved it. I was stunned by it. There were a few people who didn't speak to me for the rest of the trip, and every single one of them loathed it. It's that kind of experience. It's such a confrontational film that I can see exactly why they hated me for taking them to it. It's incredible, but it is astonishingly impactful, I think, it is what I would say about it. It's really impressive, yeah.
So, yeah, I agree with you. It's not easy to sit through, but it's a powerful film, and you're right about her performance. Like, I mean, anything less, I mean, anybody else or anybody who couldn't do what she did, I mean, this would not have worked whatsoever. And, you know, those particular things you just talked about, I mean, yeah. I mean, it is not easy to sit through, and I honestly would really like to see Tim Roth direct again, but I can imagine this film would have taken a lot out of him with it.
Yeah, I mean, it's a terrible shame that he hasn't stepped behind the camera again, but you can kind of see why. I mean, what an experience it must have been trying to make this film. Yeah. But, yeah.
Mm, absolutely. I'm not sure if the others have seen it.
Yeah, I can't really add much more.
That's right.
But it's an incredible piece of work. It's just devastating is the word. And yeah, Tim Roth is a massively talented director, more so than I thought he would be. And it's a shame he hasn't got back behind the camera again. And in the future, I hope he does. But in a way, if he doesn't, it's like this one film, this one perfect bleak little masterpiece, really. It is fine if that's all we have from him. Fantastic performances, really powerful stuff.
I haven't seen it, but I'd have to work up a lot of courage to watch it.
Yeah, I mean, it is that kind of movie, definitely.
Mm.
Not to say I would never watch it. I will watch it at some point, just not in a huge rush to check it out. I will at some point, but yeah, like I said, I need a lot of courage and a lot of alcohol to watch it. Just say.
Yeah, okay, it's upsetting.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. B, do you want to hit us up with your final pick?
My final pick? Now, I must say, like The Woodsman, this is the film I haven't seen in a number of years. So I am sort of vague on certain parts of it, but sort of thinking about it now and putting it on the list, I definitely want to go check it out again. And it's a movie that really I found impactful when I saw it a few years ago because of one particular performance in the film. And my last pick is John Lone in Iceman, which is a 1984 sci-fi drama that was directed by Australian director Fred Skepsi. It stars Timothy Hutton, who plays an anthropologist.
What was that beat? An anthropologist, man?
Anthropologist, I think that they said.
Anthropologist.
Yeah, he's in the Arctic, and then he and his and the group of scientists that he's working with there, they discover the body of a prehistoric man, who's played by John Lone, who's been frozen in a block of ice for thousands upon thousands of years, and they decide to let's check this out. So they sort of try to see what happens, like dissecting all that by unfreezing his body, but they find out that he's still alive, and they sort of bring him back to life, and they sort of decide to study him and find out like how on earth could he have survived in a block of ice for thousands of years. But John Lone's performance, he really the only other, like, I've seen him in a few other films. I've seen him, like, he's an Asian actor who's sort of appeared in other films like Kiss of the Dragon. And probably his most famous for is playing the lead in The Last Emperor. And this movie actually was made a few years before that film. And he is absolutely astonishing in the film. He really inhabits the character. Well, in the movie, Timothy Hutton names him Charlie in the movie. And he's become sympathetic towards Charlie in the film, because all the scientists want to do is, just study him and all that. But he wants to see, like, what makes him tick, like, as, as a human being. And he tries to get involved, like, study him in his own way by trying to be friends with him and trying to get him to cope, with this whole new world that he's in. But he's very terrified and very scared of this whole new world. And it's not the world that he came from. But John Lone's Charlie, he really inhabits the character. You honestly think, I'm not sure how a real life prehistoric man would act or behave.
Encino Man would be a really good indication.
Not really.
That was a joke.
As much as that movie has its charms and it has its silly charms, but this is definitely like the more serious.
Yeah, I know.
Now people are just going to think it's the same movie.
But it's definitely
much more than that film, because he really, like I said before, I'm not sure how a prehistoric man would act and behave if one was found alive in this day and age. But from watching this film, like, you can definitely see how one would behave, because John Lone, he really inhabits the character so much that you honestly think that this guy is a man from prehistoric times. Like, he is that convincing. This isn't,
like, it's
like,
believable, you mean? Like, if this was
so
real.
Yeah, it's so believable on every single level, and you sort of get to know him as a character. There are scenes where he's been trying to speak English, and, you know, he only speaks a few words, but he's very, it's a very a physical performance. Like, it's through physicality. Like I said, he doesn't speak much in the movie, so he sort of shows off all of his emotions of his character through the physicality, through, like, his body, but also in his facial expressions. And it's an astonishing performance. And I saw this film maybe 8 years ago, and I have been wanting to go check it back ever since. And it's one of those films that was got a lot of critical acclaim at the time, but it seems to have just been forgotten about. But ever since I saw the film, I was just so floored by his performance. But because John Lone, as the character Charlie, he brings a lot of like a bit of humor, a bit of intensity, but also a tragedy to the character. Like, it's a very well developed character for, you know, I guess you could say, quote unquote, a caveman character. So, yeah, it's an astonishing performance. And if you haven't seen Iceman, definitely it's worth checking out. And sort of now, actually, like I said before, talking about this film now has actually wanted me to go back and check it out again.
Yeah, I think you've convinced me to have a look at it, because I've never heard of it.
I'm surprised. Well, you're not the first. I know a lot of people who have not even heard of this film.
No, I didn't know of his existence.
The only other person I know who has seen this movie is our friend AJ.
I was going to say, I bet it's AJ.
AJ's seen everything.
He has.
Well, like him, like me, he's seen everything too. But he would, I think if he was here on the show tonight, he would agree with me with my assessment on John Lone. And I actually think this is one of the great performances never to be nominated for an Oscar. I don't know how people didn't notice it, but I suppose, like I said, it had the acclaim, but I think it just was came in cinemas and just completely forgotten about right away, which is a shame. And it's definitely as one of the best films Fred Skepsi has ever done. And it's also a very intelligent sci-fi movie. And it doesn't dumb it down, and it actually is very smart, and it does a very good job at doing it, looking at this everything in this film at a scientific standpoint as well. So, yeah, Iceman, great movie, and it has pretty good supporting cast. It has, like, David Strathairn and Danny Glover.
And not to be confused with Encino Man.
And not to be confused with Encino Man. Although, it's funny enough, Brendan Fraser has taken over the podcast. He's been mentioned a dozen times tonight on the show.
Apparently.
I think you should just name this entire podcast the Brendan Fraser Show.
I'm gonna dedicate it to him.
Yes. Yeah, if you want to see like a really smart and intelligent version of Encino Man, definitely check out Iceman. I mean, seriously, watch it. It's a great movie.
I believe you.
And it's emotional, and it has a very beautiful ending as well, and very sad as well, so check it out.
As well.
Has anyone seen Iceman other than me?
No, I have to say, I have heard of it, but I haven't seen it. I've just put it into my Amazon basket, because it's another one that I'm going to buy that you've convinced me to buy today, but it sounds fantastic.
It's like I said, even I want to go back and check this film.
Yeah,
I'm
going to track it down now.
Yeah.
Sam.
Have you seen it?
No, I've got a vague recollection of hearing of it, but not really much more than that. But yeah, I mean, it sounds very interesting. Definitely. Yeah. So I will try and check it out at some point. But yeah, I haven't heard of it, I'm afraid.
That's right.
Alrighty, and for the last one of the podcast, we'll send it back to Mike.
Okay, so my last pick is actually kind of a bit of a cheat. Again, I was just going to do one, but I'm going to focus on a particular film and do the two performances together.
All
right. It's a film called Waking the Dead, which has been all but forgotten because it went into independent cinemas in the US and got no audience, went straight to the DVD in the UK and got no audience, and around the rest of the world I don't even think has been released. And it's a supernatural drama directed by Keith Gordon, who is also an actor, and it's another of my favourite films, and I really wish people would get around to seeing it. It's about a congressional candidate played by Billy Crudup, who is very passionate and grounded in the real world. He's kind of idealistic in terms of his career path. He makes a joke one day. Well, it seems like a joke. He makes a joke about wanting to be the president, but, you know, he really completely means it. And he falls in love with this idealistic, in the sense of she wants to save the world, activist, played by Jennifer Connelly, in a role that she really deserves more praise for. And they basically form this relationship, which is built up both on the most pure kind of movie romance, but also political and social beliefs. And they have these debates, which are really intelligent and heartfelt, and they have that emotional backing behind them. And their chemistry is some of the best I've ever seen on screen. And but what happens around in the middle of the film, and this isn't a spoiler, because actually the first scene is... Billy Crudup's character discovering this, and then the rest of the film, the first half of the film, plays out before this. She goes out to a country, I can't remember where, to try and improve their way of life, and there's a terrorist cell and she dies. And then the second half of the film is him basically falling apart, thinking that he sees her ghost somewhere, except that it's really ambiguous because you don't know whether she actually died and she's just following him and she's kind of watching his life develop, but she's too afraid to go back to him, or whether she is actually dead and she's a ghost. And he starts going mad. He has this breakdown and goes through this real emotional turmoil. And then the final scene brings them together and, again, leaves it ambiguous of whether that interaction ever really happened. And it's a really beautiful film, really romantic, really just, but also very grounded. It's not slushy in any way or cliched. It's really just poignant and thought-provoking and real. And it's all of those things because of these two central performances by Jennifer Connelly and Billy Crudup, who I think they're both really fantastic actors who don't really get their due. I know Jennifer Connelly has an Oscar now, I think, for A Beautiful Mind, but she really doesn't get as much recognition as a really versatile actress that she deserves. And Billy Crudup, I think, is perhaps the best actor of his generation. If you look at films like Jesus' Son, Almost Famous, even Watchmen, which he was like one of the good things about that film, although I like that more than most people, he's just consistently amazing in every role that he takes on. And he's a really brave actor, and he really gets into the skin of each character. And here, just from the first scene where he's staring at the television, seeing the news report of her death, just collapsing from the inside, holding his head in his hands, crying uncontrollably, to the kind of final scene where he's completely different to the man he used to be. His ideals and his beliefs have been shattered, and he just connects with this woman, perhaps again for the last time. It's just a heartbreaking performance, and I wish the film had done better, because I feel like this is a performance that would have been really awarded, and it would be something that we'd still be talking about now. But as it is, no one has seen the film, and it's such a shame because he's amazing, and so is she.
I've heard of it. I haven't seen it. It's I guess, something I've wanted to see because I love those actors. So it's just a matter of finding it, watching it, you know?
Yeah.
And I agree with you about Billy Crudup and even Jennifer Connelly, definitely. I mean, they're fantastic in, you know, just about everything they do. So, yeah.
Yeah, they really are.
Yeah, definitely.
Yeah, on Billy Crudup, I would also mention Stage Beauty, which I think is a really underrated film. I have seen it. I saw it, though, when it came out on tape. And though I have the DVD, I haven't seen it since. I must get around to rewatching it. It's just, you know, one of those hundreds of things that I must get around to rewatching.
Yeah.
And you know how it is, mate. There's always a hundred other things that you haven't seen.
Oh, I know. Already, so, I know. Yeah.
You know. But yeah, I remember liking it a great deal. I remember thinking that they were both very good in it. And certainly since then, I have come to like Jennifer Connelly a lot as well. I think, you know, she's a very – and this is kind of where it started, I think, for her, because her career really went up a gear and she really became something pretty special. I think this is kind of where it started, actually, where she started getting really good. Because up until then, she'd been effective and very, very pretty. But I think this is where she got serious about the acting side of it. And, you know, since then, I haven't seen A Beautiful Mind because of my Russell Crowe allergy. But, you know, pretty much everything else I've seen her in, she's just really great. Terrific actor. So, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, I got to see it again.
Pete?
Well, I've seen that movie down at the video shop, like when they used to have videos. But
I was going to say, what is this videotape you speak of?
Yeah, yes, these videotapes.
Says the person who still has a video player.
I can show you what they used to look like. I've got about 400 of them in this room.
Yeah, I still have quite the leftover collection of VHS, and I've still got my VHS player, so I shouldn't be saying that, should I? Anyway, continue,
B. Anyways, as I was saying, I used to see it down at the video shop at the time, and I always thought, just based on the cover, I thought, oh, this looked interesting, but I never actually got around to watching it. But I'll have to it, but I'll have to now for sure. Mm.
Cool.
Yes.
Yes.
And I guess I think that's a wrap from everybody for the podcast. So
yeah.
Thank you very much to our awesome guests for taking the time out of their busy schedules to come and chit-chat about these awesome performances and giving them some love.
So, always a pleasure.
Yeah, thank you very much. And
'twas a pleasure indeed.
I hope so. Hopefully you won't need too much therapy.
No, the performances got me through. That's it. I was just thinking, like, I can watch these films.
Yeah, we are very good.
So until next time, those guys have been British and we've been Australian.
But Marcy, aren't we supposed to say where people can find us if they want to harass
us? Yeah, but you know what? I can't be bothered. All right, here we go. If you want to find me, it's supermarcy.com, or you just look up supermarcy and you'll find me all over the place. If you want to find Bede, just look up Terrible Australian and you'll find him, or even look up Bede Jemine on Facebook, Twitter, wherever. He's there. If you want to find Sam, he's at 24fps.org.uk.
Or 24fpsuk on Twitter.
On Twitter. I'm getting there. And you're also on Multimedia Mouth along with Mike. And I cannot think of Mike's blog and Twitter account off the top of my head, so I'll have to let Mike say that one.
Disgraceful.
I know, I'm very sorry.
That's eFilm blog, and I think you can look me up on Twitter under that as well. I changed it recently.
You did, that's why I'm so confused, because you were under a different name.
Yeah, I understand the confusion.
Yeah. So, that's it, isn't it?
Yep. And also, Marcy, you can find me, you know, going around looking for fires and pissing on them. So, yeah.
Apparently, you're going to piss on lots of buildings and fires. What?
Yes, because I'm going to take
those fires. Why not hospitality?
Oh, yeah. Oh, my God. Hello.
I was going to piss on those fires because they were... don't have any
hospitality. The fires have not this hospitality, so he must piss upon them.
Yes.
It's our usual clean ending.
Yeah, so basically until next time, that's us pissing yes. on pissing on things that don't have hospitality. So catch you later.
See you, everyone.
See ya.
Bye.